Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 10th of June. An article in the New York Times, it was their Sunday magazine section, we found very interesting, Hooked on Gadgets and Paying a Mental Price. The bottom line of the article was there's a vibrant debate among scientists over whether technology's influence on behavior and the brain is good or bad and how significant it is. At home, people consume 12 hours of media a day on average. I repeat, 12 hours. That's astounding. When an hour spent with the internet and TV simultaneously counts as 2 hours, and that compares with 5 hours in 1960. And as our time spent with computers and all this media has changed, we have also understood more about what's going on with the human brain. Neural networks continue to develop after childhood, influenced by things like learning skills. So what is this extensive use of media doing to those neural networks in our brain? Strengthening them or making them weaker or what? We should have a very interesting hour. We have two guests with us this hour. Professor Clifford Nass is with us. Professor Clifford Nass is a Thomas Stork professor at Stanford University and is founder and also the director of the Communication Between Humans and Interactive Media Lab. His special areas of interest are automobile interfaces, mobile interfaces, human-robot interaction, cognitive and social effects of multitasking, adaptive and personalized systems, and voice interfaces. He discovered that people use the same rules when interacting with technology as they do with interacting with other people, and he is featured in that aforementioned article in the New York Times, and we thank him for being with us. Professor Clifford Nass, hello. Thank you for being with us.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
Do you have a computer in front of you as we're doing this interview?
No, I'm actually a non-multitasker.
You're not a multitasker.
Correct.
Oh, wonderful. One of the few human beings in the world who isn't. Also joining us today by phone from, I think he's in Barcelona right now, is Professor Adam Ghazali. He's at the University of California, San Francisco. And he is assistant professor of neurology, physiology, and psychiatry, and director of the Neuroscience Imaging Center. He focuses on understanding the neural mechanisms of memory and attention in humans and how these processes change with normal aging and dementia and how we might intervene to improve cognitive abilities in those who are suffering from deficits. Professor Ghazali, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So this figure absolutely astounded me, that we spend 12 hours a day on average. Isn't that excessive? Whoever wants to start. Professor Nass, why don't you start?
Well, it's very large. It's growing very rapidly, and it's certainly unprecedented. And it's not clear that those 12 hours are time usefully spent if the goal is actually to consume, thoughtfully consume information. But it is growing across all populations, and it's something we have to at least confront.
And Professor Ghazali, have we determined, we were able to look at the brain much more closely now, some effects of that kind of attention to medium, to media, what it may do for our brains? What has it done?
Well, in general, I think we're getting a better view at how we deal with multitasking and how the brain deals with it or doesn't deal with it. So in the context of changes in societal sort of habits and style on how we interact with our media and the increase in media that we now carry in our pockets and we can interact with at all times and that almost seem to be designed to enable us to multitask, we've learned, we've addressed how this translates into our brain's reaction to it. One thing that's become very clear, and we've had this impression for a while, we begin to understand the neural mechanisms better, but what we know is that the brain doesn't really do a great job at multiple things at the same time. Mm. It tends to rather prefer to switch between things. And if you try to do multiple things and you wind up switching between them, it seems that there's a performance cost each time you make one of these switches. So that's what we're trying to understand now using brain imaging, how this actually occurs.
And it's almost hard to resist the temptation to multitask, isn't it? Those of us in this business, we may be preparing for a show which requires a whole lot of reading and very serious reading, which is a great thing. But you're also sitting in front of your computer and you're so tempted to punch on to the news to find out what's going on in the news. And then you get distracted and you're reading news stories that are not at all relevant to what it is you're supposed to be studying. But you can't help yourself.
I think that it's incredibly tempting to multitask. I happen to, unlike Dr. Nasta, tend to be a multitasker myself. And the reports, and I still think there's a lot more need for study in this, but it does seem that people almost have an obsessive, maybe even some ways an addictive attraction to multitasking. It certainly seems to be more fun for people to engage in multitasking, probably because of the novelty aspects of it, rather than doing one continuous, sustained activity. But it certainly seems that there's a strong draw to it, as we see how common it is across, you know, age groups and cultures for people to engage in this type of behavior.
Mm-hmm. Professor Nash, do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, we really see two types of multitaskers. The dominant one is exactly as described. People seem to believe that new information is better than old information, and the new is always more important and more exciting. There's another group which I certainly fall into, which is one that people multitask when they want to do anything but what they're doing right now. You know, so when you're writing, you sometimes say, "Gosh, I'd be doing anything but writing." And the facility and ease with which one can find an opportunity to do something else is just very, very large.
The New York Times article also said this, that research shows computer use may have neurological advantages. A study showed that internet users showed greater brain activity than non-users, suggesting they were growing their neural circuitry. Professor Ghazali, what do you think of that?
Well, I'm not directly familiar with that study, but we do have lots of evidence along those lines that, you know, engaging in mental activity certainly grows, you know, neural networks and more intricate communication between brain areas. So it's certainly not surprising. Whether or not it's specific for computers versus reading versus social interactions, you know, I'm not aware that we've really plucked out those details, and I'm sure there's lots of individual variability, and it depends what you're engaged in. But in general, you know, it seems to make sense given what we know about how the brain responds to, you know, stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
And activity per se is not necessarily a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's useful activity. I can, you know, there's all sorts of things we can do to stimulate areas of the brain that aren't currently stimulated at a given moment, but it doesn't really mean we're achieving any of the goals we wanted to achieve.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, useful,
yeah,
like
maybe even working against certain goals is certainly another way of extending that, maybe in a more negative direction. But you know, I agree entirely that just throwing out brain activity as some sort of standard that we're trying to achieve is maybe misdirected.
So, how do we define useful activity?
I mean, one way is, you know, useful is such a loaded term. It's so hard. I think that what you really have to do is consider it in comparison or relative to the goals that you're trying to achieve. So if, you know, if your goals are to improve your reading abilities, then maybe, you know, if types of neural activity could be related to reading, then that would be something that would be desired. But just looking at activity and, you know, in itself, and also thinking of useful as a term that means anything without considering the specific goals is, you know, difficult.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take an example. Let's take two people, one of whom is studying what's happening with the U.S. economy, what the effects of the TARP stimulus money were. And one person is reading a lengthy article, fairly well written, but technical about that. The other person is hopping from place to place on the internet, trying to get a lot of different opinions on that. What different things are happening in the brain with those different ways of studying a subject?
Well, I think one thing that's important to make clear is for most of the field, when we talk about multitasking, media multitasking, we're talking about unrelated activities.
I see.
So our brains are certainly built to integrate a variety of information. You can imagine our ancestors hunting. They would want to integrate sights, smells, sounds, everything they could about the animal they were hunting and perhaps any predators that were about. Our brains are very well adapted for that. The difference would be if our hunting ancestors were also trying to pay attention to all sorts of other things. Now, of course, they couldn't do it. They didn't have the media available. They didn't. But the analogy would be, you know, watching TV while hunting and listening to a different musical show and reading a book about yet another subject. That's really where the challenges to cognitive processing and the effects we seem to be seeing arise from.
I know that many will identify with what I find in my household is that there's a whole generation of young people who are texting pretty much nonstop. In my house, they're texting at the same time they're doing homework, at the same time they may be talking on the phone with somebody, at the same time they're looking at the internet. It just dumbfounds me.
Yeah, I would echo those comments entirely that our brains are very, very effective at adapting multiple streams of information for a common goal. It's what we describe in our research as interruptions, things that discontinue a line of investigation or direction that you might be traveling in and attempts to do a secondary task that is unrelated. It seems that when that occurs, from looking at some of the brain connectivity measures that we use in our study, what you see is that you basically drop the first task and switch and then need to resume it. And so because you keep, you know, switching between processes and not just integrating between multiple streams that are feeding to a common goal, you know, this is what interrupts and maybe decreases the quality. And the type of things that we're talking about probably, you know, as Dr. Nash said, probably one present throughout our evolution where we had so many different streams of potential information that we can keep switching. And now, you know, as you described, we have developed, you know, we're very creative at developing ways for us to be distracted and to be multitasking at the same time. And it seems to be just increasing exponentially every time a new device comes out. I mean, you know, I feel that I have an iPad now and an iPhone and a laptop going frequently at the same time. So I don't know what the next 5 years will hold, but we seem to be on an exponential rise in the number of devices that we can use simultaneously.
Well, it's interesting that you're doing that because you're a professor and you're studying all of this and you know what the consequences are. Is it that you just can't help yourself?
Well, So since I've been studying this more and more, I actually have curbed my behavior a bit.
All right.
I feel that multitasking is great when you're doing something boring that doesn't require an incredibly high degree of concentration. You sort of want to get through it. You're having trouble getting through it. And so by coupling in other things and switching back and forth, it's more enjoyable. You get through your morning of doing these menial tasks. But when I am engaged in something that I want to be at a high quality, maybe something that's pressured with a time, with a deadline,
right,
I quit my email program. Sometimes I even turn my phone into airplane mode, close my door, and really do one thing at a time. And it's only been over the last year or so that I've been thinking so much about this issue that I've actually changed my behavior and realized that really high quality performance demands doing one thing at a time.
Hmm. And if that is the case that we need to do that in order to perform very well at something that is important to do, do we lose the ability to be able to do one task at a time very thoroughly if we're spending so much time doing all these other things? Or is it just so boring to be involved in one way of study that we just don't do it? We can't do it. We lose the ability to do it.
Well, our research seems to suggest a very strong relationship between people who multitask very frequently and an, ironically, an inability to multitask, and furthermore, an inability to focus even when they can focus. It seems that people who multitask frequently just can't wait to be distracted.
Right.
And even when they know that they want to, and in fact, then when they really want to focus, they just don't seem to have the same ability. We've done studies on tasks that don't involve multitasking at all, just require intense focus on a single task. And even there in the New York Times, there's actually a test you can take yourself on how well you can focus. And the answer is that even when asked to do a single thing, the heavy multitaskers just don't seem to be able to manage it.
And why is that, Dr. Ghazali? Is it because they've lost part of the brain circuitry?
I'm fascinated by Dr. Nass's research on this. We haven't investigated it from the same direction of, you know, more societal and relation to media, but it certainly seems that there's a correlation there. You know, the causal aspects of it are
right.
Still an intriguing question. Are people that multitask those that just don't do it as well? That would sort of seem like a strange explanation, but certainly the data, my impression is that it doesn't argue against that. If it is true that people that engage in media multitasking to this degree sort of adopt a cognitive style, maybe as a way of thinking about it, where they just lose, you know, the skills, the practice that is required to really engage in something in a sustained way, it's fascinating. And, you know, I think it has large implications and, you know, makes you wonder about groups of people that may have never developed these skills, like children. I mean, you know, we
yes.
have been, you know, gone through education in a certain way where we, you know, didn't have cell phones in our pockets, a lot of us, and we really read books for hours on end without checking our text. And, you know, so I think that those studies are provocative and really lead me to question what are the implications of this.
Right. And yet it's hard to stop it, isn't it, when you think about what people are doing and all the technology available, and it's so incorporated in so many people's lives. How do you, I know you turned it off some, Dr. Ghazali, but how do you turn it off?
Well, it's, you know, part of the problem is it's not just people's volitions, people's desire to shut it off. So much of social norms have changed to demand multitasking.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The idea that if I don't respond to a phone call in a very rapid time or a text or an email, many companies now say, you know, you must, whatchamacallit, pick up, you know, answer your email within 15 minutes to be responsible.
Oh, my goodness.
You must have chat windows, multiple chat windows up 24/7 as you're working. So I think that, in fact, when we were researching this here, and I asked a group of undergraduates if I could give them, you know, money to just try not multitasking for a year to look at the effects, for a week, I'm sorry, they all said no. We can't give it up. It would be so destructive to our daily life that we just can't do it. And so I think even if one wanted to, so much social pressure to continually be in touch, to respond so rapidly, just really forces us on people.
Yeah, I have, you know, not from a research perspective, but certainly the same intuition, that it's not just the media that we have that allows us to multitask. Is really a change in expectations of responsivity. I mean, there was a time when you went on vacation, it was expected that you were actually out of touch. And that's not true anymore. You know, I'm in Barcelona right now, and I mean, granted, I'm at a conference, but, you know, if I really go with a day without email, it's tough, because a lot of those emails just expect the fact that I'm reading them as they're coming in.
Sure.
And
right.
It's not entirely always appropriate that you know, that degree of, you know, being wired in should be expected.
And there you are in Barcelona. You should be out of touch. Oh, my gosh.
Right. I'm in a hotel room right now looking down at a pool with everyone else relaxing at it, but I am wired in.
You are definitely wired in, across the ocean. Let's welcome phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org, and we're talking about all of this information, emails, phone calls, having all these, I don't go that far, all these screens open to you so you can chat while you're taking emails and while you're reading about what's going on in the news. We spend, most of us, because we're doing a lot of things at the same time, 12 hours a day with all of this, which is such a That's so many hours. And so what is that doing to us? What is it doing to the neural circuitry in our brains? And is it making us less able to focus? We welcome your phone calls. We have one line open if you'd like to get it right now. And make sure you get to that email right away and we'll read it as soon as we can. We promise. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, Ian Bremmer will join us. His book is The End of the Free Market, Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations. Our guests this hour, Dr. Clifford Nass, Thomas Stork Professor at Stanford University, founder and director of the Communication Between Humans and Interactive Media Lab, and Dr. Adam Ghazali, Assistant Professor of Neurology, Physiology, and Psychiatry, and director of the Neuroscience Imaging Center at the University of California, San Francisco. We go to your phone calls. Camille is our first caller from Frankfurt. Hi, Camille.
Hi.
Hi.
I would just like to suggest that if people spent as little as 1 to 3 minutes a day in meditation for every hour that they spend using technical devices, whether you're texting or on the computer, that not only would you start to reclaim a sense of autonomy, but other aspects of your life, including your work life in front of the computer, would be enhanced. And I will take your responses off the air.
Thanks, Camille. Who wants to start? Clifford, Adam?
I haven't studied that, so I have to defer.
I have not studied it either, but I'm very interested in it, and it is something that we are planning on researching. You know, a lot of what we work on in the lab are ways of improving attentional abilities, or maybe even improving this ability to multitask and resist distraction. And the approach that we're investigating is maybe what could be thought of as a very Eastern approach, sort of video games that are designed to actually improve these abilities. The other side of it, and you know, which certainly has some really interesting data and obviously a long history, is maybe what could be viewed as a more Western approach related to mindfulness training and meditation. And I'm just really fascinated by the idea of exploring both avenues and seeing how they might be similar and they might be different. So, you know, I don't know for sure how it would impact this, but it certainly is an interesting line of investigation.
Yes, it is. Anna in Madison, hi.
Hi there. I'm grinning from ear to ear as I hear this. I'm the voice of the revolution, the tasking revolution. I teach online. My full-time job is as an instructor at a technical college, and I teach all my classes online. And I also have attention deficit syndrome. And so I found that I felt like I was going to go crazy because I had all these things that I felt like they were hovering around me. Email me, call me, write me, post me. And I rebelled. I said, no, I won't. And I took email out of my life completely. I said, you can text me or call me. Let's talk on the phone. And found that so much more efficient, both for my students and myself. And then I didn't fear my computer anymore. And I killed my Twitter account and stopped using Facebook for, you know, anything other than looking at, you know, family pictures. And I think, I mean, your guests sound so knowledgeable and are doing such amazing work, but I think there is a degree of sophistry in the idea that we are forced to do these things. We actually aren't forced to do all of them. some of them, in order to remain, you know, connected, you can do, but actually sometimes less when you can be attentive and mindful, to use the words of the last caller, when you can be attentive to it and really give yourself to it, less it does end up being more and having more value. And that's all. I'll take my comments.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Anna. Great call. Let's go with you to start, Professor Nass.
So, you know, one of the interesting changes is that attentiveness has become, in some sense, less valued. More and more we see people, even in social situations, texting, doing things.
Right.
There's a lot of research, for example, that showed that when kids ate dinner with their parents at a family dinner table, all these positive results accrued. But now we see kids at the dinner table and their parents at dinner table, both of them, actually, while they're physically sitting at the same table, they're not at all engaged with each other.
Right.
They're, so we're not going to see those effects. So certainly the loss of attentiveness is beyond the cognitive problems, is an enormous social loss, and one I don't know how we reproduce.
The article in the Times that we were talking about writes about this family, and they've really lost touch with each other because they spend so much time, even on family vacations, they're with all their different gadgets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a problem, again, as we change our culture and encourage people to do things. It becomes a very complicated issue.
Mm-hmm. Arjun is next from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hey, I was just wondering about the 12-hour per day statistic. It can't possibly include, all 12 hours of it is probably not just TV shows and games online, right? It's got to include a lot of educational learning that, these days, that's internet medium is one of the best mediums you can use for educational purposes. So is that really a bad thing?
Well, you're absolutely right that certainly the internet has had enormous benefits for education and, in fact, for research. Both Adam and I would find it extremely difficult to do our research without the internet. The issue is it's very unlikely that people literally are sitting 12 hours a day in front of media. Instead, what's happening is they're using three or four media at one time. And all the research done on doing homework while you're doing other things, with the possible exception of music, which is still in uncharted domain, suggests that you're doing both less efficiently. You're learning less well and the other activity less well. So it's not that the internet hasn't proven incredibly valuable to people. It's just, if you're using it for the goal of learning or understanding, period, then it's extremely valuable. But when you're using it for a number of things simultaneously, or reading a magazine and chatting and texting while you're using it, that's where the problem lies.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's get back to this irrelevant information that evidently many of us get caught up in, just taking in information. It doesn't make any difference. It is completely irrelevant. Why do we do that? What is it about irrelevant information? How much of our brain storage is it taking up, and do we forget it right away, and does it make us forget the information that is relevant as well?
Well, that's actually more directly related to my research than a lot of the stuff we've been talking about, which is more peripherally related. But what we study is, or have been studying for quite a while, before we've even looked at multitasking, which is more recent, is looking at just what the impact of all the irrelevant information around us has on our cognition at the time, maybe our memory or our language. It could be done in any type of domain. And what we find is that even when you don't make the choice to take in multiple streams of information, which is largely what we've been talking about, sort of this conscious decision to multitask, but rather you are decided to engage in one task, there's still a lot of information around you that has to be ignored for you to do that, especially if you're, let's say, in a restaurant trying to have a conversation, and you do want to have the goal of just paying attention to the person you're talking to. You would like to maybe remember some of the conversation another day, and the restaurant is noisy, the waiter's taking an order at the next table, and so part of your goals are not just to pay attention, but to actually filter out and suppress all that irrelevant information. What we see when we do brain recording experiments while people engage in trying to accomplish a single goal in the presence of irrelevant information, that a lot of this irrelevant information gets in, and when it does, it decreases your ability to remember what you're trying to focus on. We also have a lot of data that show that this inability to filter out irrelevant information increases as we get older. We do a lot of work on 60, 70, 80-year-olds that are quite healthy, don't have any disease as far as we can detect, you know, in terms of dementia, but they have an increasing propensity to be distracted by information that's entirely irrelevant. They're not trying to attend to it. They're actually trying to ignore it, but it still gets in, and it causes this problem with their memory. So we do, you know, find that this is a big issue in really trying to have optimal performance, is to try to keep your brain focused on one thing, and sometimes it's difficult, and it seems to get worse as we get older.
And can we train ourselves to do that somehow?
We are doing that experiment right now. So that's where I sort of said this Eastern approach of video game training. We're seeing that if we expose our older individuals that participate in our studies to a task repeatedly that has lots of irrelevant information, will they improve the ability to filter it out? And will this transfer to a better memory abilities in the context of interference, as it so often occurs? So I think it's an open question. I think that we do know that people of all age groups have this ability to learn quite impressively, and there is some evidence to suggest that maybe you can learn to filter better, but it hasn't really been explored in quite as detailed a way as we would hope. So that's still an open-ended question in my mind.
Let's go to Philip next from Eau Claire. Hi, Philip.
Hi, I wanted to call in. I guess I'm a recovering internet chess addict, and I was reflecting on it since I have not been doing it for about 11 months. And I want to just share a little bit of my story. I'm a tournament chess player my whole life, and on the internet, I rose to a very, very high rating. But as I did this, I found that it was dominating my life. I was playing like 70 games at once, and the default thing would always be to go to that terminal, no matter whether I was trying to write or do a creative project or anything else. And when I was doing it, it seemed like the thing to do, even to the point of getting up in the middle of the night several times to my wife's chagrin to go play my chess games. And now I look back at it and say, I really, really, truly was addicted, but at the time it seemed like the thing to do. But with a little distance away, it seems like it was just a very scary, very dominating thing. Although I did get quite good at chess. I became a master before I walked away from it.
You're doing so well.
Yeah, but it, at the same time, this became, I have many other creative activities. I'm a published writer. I've got a book that's, and I would be doing the other things, but I would be doing them pretty badly, to be quite frank with you. And as far as interhuman reaction, I would prefer a chess terminal, and I would do that. And it was just like, that was my default until I got away from it, you know. And I wondered, and I'm actually in my 60s, too, and I wondered if anybody else had had an experience like that where it became such a dominant theme until I just walked away, actually because I got a better opportunity to get some poems published, and so I did.
Professor Nass, you want to start?
Well, you know, there is this paradox. Practice is hugely important. You know, recent books out all demonstrate that if you want to get extremely good at things, you practice them. And in fact, in many of these competitive games, chess, poker, other such games, we're seeing a dramatic improvement in play because people are able to just practice intense amounts of time. It's less clear, it's more complicated whether playing multiple games of chess or certainly poker. We see that among starring poker players, that they are always playing 10 hands at once.
Can I bring up a negative here real quickly? Just, I don't need to interrupt. But I noticed that my threshold of expectation became higher and higher. So if I won 39 games in a row, I became quite angry at losing the 40th.
Right. Well, that's part of, in some sense, what's happening is it's a very healthy human impulse to want to improve, through practice. In fact, that's probably certainly the best way to become better at something. The trick was, before, societies were designed to make it impossible for one person to do something much, 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 much more than others. If you wanted to learn to ride a horse, you couldn't ride two horses at once. Or, you know, if you wanted to become good at anything, you would have to do that thing. The dramatic change is that now on a single screen, we can do 10 things at once. And it's not well understood in our studies of practice, perhaps as more knowledge, whether, in fact, practicing the same 10 different instantiations of the same thing simultaneously is good or bad. But certainly we know that it's much less likely to be effective than simply practicing.
Thank you, Philip, very much for the call. You want to weigh on this? I weigh in on this, Dr. Ghazali?
I mean, you know, I don't know the data on practicing multiple things at the same time. My guess, based on, you know, related data, is that it would not be as effective as practicing, you know, one thing continuously. But there's a, you know, as Dr. Knapp said, there's a tremendous value in practice if you want to reach, you know, the highest levels of performance. And we do have a unique opportunity, given our media, to obtain high levels of practice. And even if it's not simultaneous, just the fact that you can sit in your home and play poker, you know, or chess throughout the night, as opposed to having to find, you know, other people in your area that are awake and willing to do it, has also increased our, you know, the ability of people to become experts at things probably at a higher level than ever before.
What about this? Do you abide by this, which I've been hearing so much on this show, that you need 10,000 hours of practice in order to become really good at anything? Is that true, and does that require kind of a single focus mind, Dr. Ghazali?
I mean, I'm aware of the same general statements that you are. I know there's been several books on the topic, and I've, you know, looked through them a bit, but not, I haven't really dove into that research to see, you know, how certain that number is, and if you don't get that number, do you not reach that level of expertise? I mean, it makes sense that more practice is going to, you know, lead you to a higher level of performance. So, you know, in general, I would think that it makes sense.
But we don't think doing 10,000 things for 1 hour is equivalent.
Right.
Right. That's true. And that would be our comment, that 10,000 things in 1 hour would not be the same as 10,000 right. hours of a single thing.
All right. Don't do 10,000 things in 1 hour, the theme of this show. We're going to welcome more phone calls momentarily. The number is 800-486-8655. We have two guests with us. Dr. Adam Ghazali, Assistant Professor of Neurology, Physiology and Psychiatry, Director of the Neuroscience Imaging Center at the University of California at San Francisco, and also Dr. Clifford Nass, who is Thomas Stork Professor, Stanford University, founder and director of the Communication Between Humans and Interactive Media Lab. We're talking this hour, actually the sparking point for the conversation from the New York Times Sunday Magazine piece, Hooked on Gadgets and Paying a Mental Price. One line is open if you'd like to join us. The rest are filled. We'll get to you in a moment. We also don't have any emails. If we'll get to your emails. That's talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ian Bremmer, our guest, the second hour of the show, his new book is The End of the Free Market, Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations. He's president of Eurasia Group, the world's leading global political risk research and consulting firm. Back to phone calls for both our guests. Christopher in Heartland is next. Hi, Christopher.
Hello.
Hello.
I have been startled by a paradox that seems to exist. When you see the child who can sit 8, 10, 12 hours in front of a video game screen, and yet, upon emerging, so to speak, they have attention problems, attention deficit, or whatever. I think that the value or the reward of the external stimuli that exists in the world may have surpassed the value or reward of the internal stimuli from whatever part of the brain, the frontal lobe, that causes that drives us to focus. I'd like to hear any comments about the internal stimuli and reward that might be, or the research that might be available.
Okay, it's a good question. Dr. Ghazali, you want to start?
Yeah, well, just in comment to the video game issue, it's a complicated one. I think there's a lot of negative data that's very valid for video games, and then there's some really interesting data showing that young adults that engage in sort of action video games show improvements in attention abilities and visual acuity measures and a whole host of attention and cognitive measures. So it's a complicated issue and one that we're still trying to figure out. In terms of external versus internal environment, I think it's a really nice way of looking at things. I tend to think about that a lot more when we consider our research. I think that there is both a very rich world outside of our brains and a rich world inside, and we're constantly moving between these. Sometimes it might be, you know, really, you know, a nice observation that if we live entirely externally and we can't stop taking in external information, maybe we deprive ourselves of a richer inner world where we just allow our minds to wander and think creatively. So I think it's a really good point. I'm not aware of a tremendous amount of data on how this balance has shifted over time, but you might expect that you know, it might have shifted because of these things. There's the flip side in that our internal world can also be a distraction, and you know, people complain about mind wandering decreasing their ability to engage in things in the external world that require their attention, maybe even driving and safety type of issues, as well as engaging in conversations and other things that are important. So I think it was an excellent question and one that I think about a lot more. From a brain recording perspective, it's much easier to study how someone interacts with external things because we can deliver the external things. We know when they're occurring. When asked to study how people interact with their internal world and their thoughts, it's a lot harder to control, and so therefore it's a lot less studied from a brain perspective.
We go to Jackie in Drummond. Hi, Jackie.
Yes, I firstly have a question, and then I'll make my comment. When you were saying, you know, people spend 12 hours, you know, with technology, were you including the radio in that?
I assume so, yes.
Then I probably fall out of what I was going to say. But I'm really a Luddite, and all, you know, through these years, I'm in my 60s, really have rejected, you know, all this technology. And when I observe people, you know, texting and looking, to me, it just enhances their ego. It just seems like it's a big ego thing, all this technology. And I certainly know what's going on and, you know, make it to all my meetings and am probably more informed from listening to public radio, you know, than a lot of people are. But I just have rejected this, and I have functioned very well, except people say, you don't read your email, do you? And that makes me angry when they say that. But is there a place for Luddites in this whole situation?
All right, well, there's a good question. How about that, Professor Nass? Is there a place for Luddites?
Well, certainly, and in fact, if it is true that the more people multitask, the less they're able to focus, and we certainly have suggestive evidence of that, then the Luddites win in the long run because they're the only people who will be able to really focus, and there's certainly a tremendous value in focusing, at least as society is currently constructed. In fact, I've spoken with teachers, for example, and you know, they've been trying to figure out how do we teach to a population that can't focus. It's a non-trivial question, but one they feel they have to answer. So I think people who are rejecting of technology will have the advantage of being able to focus. Social life is a little more complicated. We don't know how. We're about to embark on a study with tweens, kids between 8 and 13, on their media use and seeing are there positive and negative consequences of, you know, not being so interconnected. The obvious positive advantages beyond the cognitive are being social in that age group takes a lot of thought. It's when you really learn these skills.
And if they're not really getting the opportunity to focus on a social interaction because of all these other demands of and distractions, that's going to be a long-term problem. So we intend to study that. So the answer is yes, you may actually develop better social skills, even though it may be bumpy at times, and certainly the ability to focus will be an enormous plus.
Daryl is next. Hi, Daryl.
Hi. I have a conundrum or a question that I think of it every day, and nobody can give me an answer, but my kids constantly play these games like Webkinz and Millsbury, and I'm always telling them, they'll spend hours and hours doing it on the Internet. I say, you have a PlayStation 2, a Wii, you have more computing power to send a missile to the moon, but yet you will play these 8-bit games on the Internet for hours and hours. You know, there's no, you know, why do they do that? I mean, you have all this other equipment that's so much more advanced, but they will sit there on the Internet and just walk around on Webkinz. I don't understand it.
Well, you know, we know, for example, that still the most popular dolls and the most popular for boys action figures, ones that don't talk, they allow the child to project and use their imagination. And healthy kids love the ability to use their own imagination and protect. So what these very simple games do is give them an opportunity to use parts of their brain that become a relief from the real world where you can't make stuff up.
We'll go to one more phone call in a moment. I want to go back to this Times piece for a minute, and let me go to you, Dr. Ghazali, for the first response. It starts with this story of this guy who's really getting tons of messages. He's really an extreme multitasker, and he overlooks this very, very important email message where a big company wanted to buy his internet startup. And this was a $1.3 million deal, and he missed the message for 12 days. When we talked about irrelevant information, what about not being able to spot that which is important?
Yeah, I mean, it's critical to consider, you know, how, you know, broad these implications are when we are exposed to so many distractions and also at the same point trying to engage in so many activities at the same time. I think of both of those things as interference in a way on maybe accomplishing one single goal, that the very relevant information that should be capturing our attention in what I think of as a bottom-up way, that it has great salience, it's very important, or it's very novel. This is the type of environmental stimuli that kept us alive throughout evolution, and animals are incredibly adapt at picking up, you know, very subtle scents. Things that are very important, they just pick up, it just penetrates. And it does seem that maybe with all of this interference that's been created, our sensitivity to things that are important might be decreasing, and whether or not, you know, how this is going to pan out over time, I still think is a question. But, you know, you see people talking on cell phones and walking into things,
yes,
you know, while walking down the street. And there's tons of reports of this. And, you know, it's shocking because a poll should have enough salience and be relevant enough when it's in your way that it captures your attention and not get ignored as irrelevant information because you're focusing on the phone call. So, you know, I think there's lots of examples of this that our, you know, very busy worlds now have maybe allowed us to become less sensitive or cause us to become less sensitive to things that are really important in the environment.
Yeah. Dr. Ness.
Well, we also have this bizarre belief has evolved that we can do these multiple things at once, even though there's all the evidence to the contrary. I remember I was at a conference where we were discussing why, you know, the debate, quote-unquote, of whether people should text while driving. And I said, you know, someone said, well, there's been no research on this. I said, okay, well, imagine I went to NSF and said, National Science Foundation, and said, there's this activity called driving where you really need your eyes to, you know, see things and concentrate, and you need your hands to control this huge machine. And there's this other activity called texting where you need your eyes to be there instead of on the road and your hands to be elsewhere. Can I get $1 million of research to determine whether this is a good thing or not?
Right.
it's sort of a non-starter.
Yeah, exactly.
And so then when they ask people, okay, given this, what conceivable way do you believe you can do this?
I know.
But obviously people do, right? I mean, texting certainly, unfortunately, not non-existent on the roads. I think there's this bizarre faith based in essentially nothing that we can multitask. I think at most it's based on a desire to do so. It gets translated into belief we can, but it absolutely baffles me that people think they can do this.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you guys have been so informative and fun, I might add. And isn't radio a wonderful medium? Because it does require, when we were talking about concentration, it requires full concentration to make it fly. And it's one of the reasons I love it, and you're both very good at doing this. So
I haven't checked my mail once since we've been talking.
All right.
As we get off, we will.
Yeah, but I can hear.
I do have to say that, but I have not.
A lot of guests do that because I can hear it in the background. And I'm thinking, wait a second, you're supposed to be talking to us. And I've never said it to him, but after this conversation, maybe I will. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Our thanks to Dr. Clifford Nass, who's at Stanford University, founder and director of the Communication Between Humans and Interactive Media Lab, and also Professor Adam Ghazali, assistant professor of neurology, physiology, and psychiatry, and director of the Neuroscience Imaging Center at the University of California, San Francisco. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. News is coming up, and we'll return for another hour.